From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn more about how out-of-state landlords are buying Milwaukee properties at an alarmingly fast pace. Then we'll listen to some new music from local musicians, including a new solo track from Immortal Girlfriends Matthew.
This is a very fascinating mix of genres and styles. There's definitely the synth element from Immortal Girlfriend there, but there's also these interesting like acoustic guitar flourishes.
Plus, we'll learn about exoplanets and how the James Webb Telescope is capable of capturing them.
And the cool thing about infrared light is that you can see through murk. You can see through dust and clouds that visible light would not be able to see.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Out-of-state landlords are competing with Milwaukeeans for housing. More and more companies from places like California or Ohio are buying homes on Milwaukee's north side from local landlords. These out-of-state companies are primarily looking to make a profit, which is changing the fabric of the city's neighborhoods. Talith Shelbourne is an investigative solutions reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John D. Johnson is the Lubar Research Fellow at Marquette Law School. They've both reported on this trend, and they explain what's happening with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
You both worked and reported about how out-of-state landlords are changing the shape of Milwaukee's neighborhoods and changing and affecting the number of affordable housing options that are available here in this city. And both of you got to talk to local landlords, talk to neighbors within the neighborhoods that are affected, and even the mayor of Milwaukee. But how much of the rental landscape homes and properties owned in Milwaukee are owned by out-of-state landlords?
About one-fifth of all the rental houses in Milwaukee are now owned by a landlord who's headquartered out of state. And about a fifth of those houses are owned by one of the three largest private equity-backed investors who've entered the market recently. Many of them are from California and Texas and Florida, these kinds of states. Of the three largest companies, two of them are from California and one of them is from Ohio, actually. And they target investment here because it's very profitable to be a landlord in poor neighborhoods in Milwaukee because rents are comparatively high, even though home values are comparatively low.
Yeah, and I just want to jump in on that and add that the reason that they're kind of targeting Milwaukee as opposed to their own backyard is because affordability is relative, right? So what you can get in California, you can probably get a lot more here, as well as some of the other places that these big kind of companies are coming in from. And that's their impetus to invest in these types of markets, which are relatively affordable for them.
Which neighborhoods are they mostly targeting to look at and buy property?
Mostly on the north side of the city. In fact, the east side of the city mostly saw a decline in the number of properties owned by out-of-state landlords in the last few years. The south side, there's relatively limited activity by these investors. But on the north side, we've seen really large growth in the number of houses owned by out-of-state investors. So the 1st and 7th aldermanic districts lead the way. These include neighborhoods like Old North Milwaukee, Silver Spring, Hampton Heights, Uptown, St. Joe's, those kinds of areas.
We're talking about out-of-state landlords at the moment, but in terms of like generally the percentage and the number of people who are from the Milwaukee area or who already live in the community, what does homeownership look like in this property ownership landscape for Milwaukeeans or people from the Wisconsin area?
About 70% of houses in Milwaukee are owner-occupied now. It was 80% before the housing crisis, and then it fell to 68% in 2018. Owner occupancy actually declined year over year from about 2006 all the way through 2018. The housing crisis lasted an extremely long time in Milwaukee. Since 2018, in the just about 4 years since then, we've seen an increase in each year of owner occupiers in the city. It's risen by 3,000 houses since 2018. And that increase has occurred in pretty much every part of the city.
And I'm just curious to tell us, you got to talk to somebody who is from Milwaukee, is a Milwaukeean, and on their journey of purchasing a home. Generally, what has that looked like for the person you were talking to in your story about their journey to purchasing a home here in Milwaukee?
So in this particular story, I spoke to someone actually who wanted to purchase their neighbor's home. They had lived in a neighborhood that had once been very primarily owner occupied, full of residents who owned their homes. And over time that changed, and it changed in particular for their next door neighbor who passed away, and their relatives, you know, they were not able to keep up with the taxes on the house. It fell to the city, and eventually it was purchased by a landlord that has a very interesting kind of opaque ownership kind of history, but they claim to be Mequon based. And this particular property was being, you know, inhabited by tenants that a lot of the, at least this particular homeowner felt were not helping the neighborhood image, were kind of bringing chaos and drama to the neighborhood. And they were concerned about that. And one of the things that they said was, we wish that there was a way for people who've lived here a long time to be able to access these homes before they're, you know, available to these types of investor landlords, these types of landlords, even on a semi-local basis, who will rent to, you know, they rent to tenants, and their primary concern is about getting a profit out of the property. And also she pointed out too that there was an issue with how the property was being maintained. It was once a very, you know, beautiful home that the homeowner who had lived there had put, you know, thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours of work into the home. And it went from being valued at, you know, more than $100,000 to like less than $40,000 by the time it was purchased and being rented out.
There are people on a local level, community members from Milwaukee, who want to purchase homes and want to purchase affordable homes, but they are in competition really with out-of-state bigger landlords, companies that swoop in to purchase these properties and these affordable housing units. And from both of your reporting, how are these out-of-state landlords or out-of-state property owners able to acquire so much property so quickly and seemingly so much faster than local community members are able to purchase these properties? Why is this all happening?
Yeah, so I really wanted to answer that question coming from a bit of a different angle than we traditionally come at, and that is, who's selling to these out-of-state investors? And it seems as though the majority of these bulk sales are coming from other local landlords who are getting out of the business or who are just looking to downsize their portfolios here. So the reason that they're not accessible to homeowners is because they're selling them in package deals. And even though the homes are priced affordably individually, they're not priced affordably when they're, you know, sold in a package. For instance, if you have 10 homes, I think at, you know, 80 grand, an individual person might be able to afford that. But if they have to pay 800 grand because you're selling all of them at once, you know, that really takes them out of the equation. And so the reason that these local landlords are doing that is because it's really about time and getting the money right away, as opposed to going through the process of selling them individually, listing them on an MLS website, working with a realtor, and going through that whole kind of individual home buyer process. So, and it's in a sense more convenient, even though, as it was you know, reported in the story that I wrote, sometimes they lose money because they can actually get more for the homes individually. But it's just a trade-off that a lot of them are willing to make.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, Talis, that people who are, you know, trying to buy these affordably priced homes to live in aren't being beaten on like the price. They're not being outbid on a per property basis on these houses. It's that the transactions are taking place outside of this public retail market entirely. And this is an important difference from the way Milwaukee's housing market was working in the early and mid 2010s. At that time, we saw a lot of out-of-state investment also going on, but they were mostly buying from distressed owner-occupiers and foreclosures and pre-foreclosure kinds of sales. But in the last few years, there haven't been very many foreclosures at all. And in fact, we've had this increasing number of owner-occupiers. And so instead of buying these houses from owner-occupiers who are losing their houses, now these out-of-state investors are having to go look somewhere else. And the place where they're looking is the small local landlords, as Talis just explained.
Yeah, and there's a lot happening within housing where more people want to own a home. And of course, like we're talking about now out-of-state landlords managing properties here in Wisconsin. But what is being done in the city to make sure that Milwaukeeans have access to affordable homes, either to rent or to buy? What needs to happen to make sure that there's enough affordable homes for people who are already living here?
There's been city organizations like Axe Housing that have, you know, they've set a goal to try to purchase and compete with these kinds of the big three that John mentioned and other investor landlords. So they're trying to go into these less transparent forums and you know, get in a lot of these types of backdoor deals that are happening, package sales, things like that. But at the same time, it's limited because of Act 176, which, you know, prohibits a lot of what the city itself can do. And that's just around, you know, maintenance and inspections. But there's other laws from the state legislature that kind of limit whether or not we can regulate this particular type of sell, this particular type of neighborhood shift. And that makes it really tricky and kind of leaves it up to nonprofits and individuals to try and make a difference.
Yeah, and what potentially could the long-term impact be if this trend continues within Milwaukee's neighborhoods with private investors buying properties in bulk across especially the north side of Milwaukee? How could that change the fabric of our neighborhoods?
What I tried to make really clear in the story that Mike and I wrote is that there is actually very strong demand from people in Milwaukee to buy houses in Milwaukee. And these investors are not out competing them on price. They're out competing them with their ability to buy in bulk. Something that really concerns me is that when properties become owned by large landlords, I think it's increasingly unlikely that any of those properties will be listed on the public market for an owner-occupier to buy in the future, because as landlords get bigger, from what I can tell, they are increasingly likely to sell their properties in these sort of portfolio sales exclusively to other landlords in the future. And so you have a situation where many houses in Milwaukee are pretty affordably priced and in fact would likely be cheaper for their tenants to own rather than to rent. And as we've seen in the last few years, there's strong demand by residents in Milwaukee to become owner-occupiers. It's a good financial decision for many people in the city, but increasingly these houses are owned in such a way that makes it unlikely that they'll ever go on the public market.
Yeah, and just to add to that, there's two things that I kind of see coming ahead that are very concerning. One is demographic change. So in the case that I mentioned with the neighbor Roundtree, you know, her neighbor passed away and the relatives didn't want the house. Sometimes relatives are not able to take care of a house. Sometimes they're not even living in the same state. And there's going to be a lot of demographic shifts in terms of baby boomers who are aging out and the silent generation, which is already aging out. And what's going to happen to those legacy homes if these relatives or the, you know, owners of the homes themselves are not prepared to try to protect them from being snapped up by these types of investors? And then the other thing I'm concerned about is, and this is probably a little bit further in the future, but I think it's something to think about now, is, you know, Milwaukee is going to be the state of Wisconsin in its totality is going to be considered a climate destination. And if most of the real estate in its major city is owned by investor landlords, what is that, you know, what does that do to the population that lives here and works here and doesn't own a home? That's going to put a lot of power out of the hands of tenants, which is going to make it, I think, potentially a hostile environment to be a renter in. And that's something that we really should think about and try to prepare for now before it gets to that point.
ultimately, too, from both of your reporting and just looking at just the experiences of the folks that you got to talk to, what big change really needs to happen within the Milwaukee housing market to protect individual families and individual homeowners to make sure that they aren't being, you know, excluded from potentially buying a home from these landlords?
In a perfect world, I would love for there to be a requirement that when people sell houses, they're required to list them individually on the public market. So any member of the public is able to put in an offer on that house if they're financially able to do so, rather than having homes being sold in these bundled package deals that take place in investor-only markets. But I am excited about this acquisition fund that Axe Housing is starting in collaboration with some other partners. Their goal is to compete for package sales with investors and then turn around and sell those houses to individual owner occupiers. But even if they're as successful as they hope to be, that'll only help a few hundred houses in the city a year, which is more than a drop in the bucket in a city the size of Milwaukee. It could be a great thing, but it won't solve the entire problem. I hope that listeners to this show who are perhaps in the position of selling a house, or maybe their parents will be selling a house sometime in the future, will think seriously about listing their house on the public market in the sort of traditional way, rather than just taking the first offer that they will, I think, almost inevitably receive from one of these investors. So there are things that individuals can do. When you read the literature provided by the largest landlords for their investors and things like that, it's very clear that when they choose a market to invest in, they spend a lot of time thinking about the regulatory environment. So if they perceive a local government as vigorously enforcing code violations and things like that, they are less likely to invest in that community. So local governments can influence the behavior of these landlords in some respects. Their hands are not completely tied.
Talis Shelbourne is an investigative solutions reporter with the focus on affordable housing, environment, and equity issues at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John D. Johnson is the Lubar Research Fellow at Marquette Law School. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Later in the show, we'll explore the universe of exoplanets and how NASA's James Webb Telescope is helping bring these worlds to life. But first, we'll hear some new local tunes in this month's Milwaukee Music Roundup, including a new song from a former Lake Effect intern. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's officially the holiday season, and many of us are gathering with friends and family for celebrations. Here on Lake Effect, we're celebrating all things Milwaukee music with Milwaukee Record co-founder Matt Wild. Every month, he creates a list of some of the best new releases from local musicians, and he joins us to share a few of those songs. Matt Wild, as always, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you once again for having me.
So we're starting off with an artist who I believe used to have another name attached to the front of it, but now he is known simply as Newski.
As Newski, yes. All caps, Newski. I'm speaking, of course, about the hardest working musician in Milwaukee show business, Brett Newsky. Brett, like I said, is just a busy, busy fellow. He has been putting out music for more than a decade now, seems to release a new album, a new EP, a new video, a new podcast every other week. He is a busy, busy guy. And surprise, surprise, he has a recent new EP out. It is called Theoretical Soul. The song we're going to be listening to from Theoretical Soul is called Wet Pavement. Now, this is actually a older song. I think it dates back to about 2013 or so. This was written back then when Brett was on tour in Vietnam. He has a very, very fascinating story where he did some time in Vietnam. He wrote, while he was there, I believe he wrote a jingle for feminine hygiene products in Vietnam. He has these kind of stories, all these kinds of very bizarre and fun stories from his career. And so this song, Wet Pavement, dates back to those days. I believe this is a re-recorded version of it. And he calls it the sidewalk version of this song. And he also has a video, a new video, that has old footage from him in Vietnam about a decade ago. And it's always been one of my favorite Brett Newsky songs. So it's nice that it's gotten a little revamp here and a re-record. And I think it sounds great. And it's always great to hear new stuff from, I guess I should just call him now, Newsky. So yes, this is Newsky with Wet Pavement.
The new faces talk the pavement, get stuck in some dangerous places, look less lovely.
Wet Pavement by Newsky. Now, the next song that we're looking at, it's I described it in my notes as fascinating. It feels like it's out of a completely different era in some ways. It's very futuristic. It has almost a Tron feel to it, but the vocals aren't robotic. They feel very organic.
Absolutely. This is the latest song from a new act called Mathu. And it's actually not really a new act. This is Kevin Bush from, he's one half of the Milwaukee group Immortal Girlfriend. Now, we've talked about Immortal Girlfriend, I believe, many times on the show. They are this terrific brother duo, kind of retro futuristic electro duo. And one of the brothers from that group, William, he has a side project that I know we've talked about as well called Black Challenger, which is very similar to Immortal Girlfriend, very retro-futuristic. And now Kevin Bush is finally stepping outside the Immortal Girlfriend banner for the first time and releasing his own music under kind of this solo moniker, Mathu. And he has a new record out called Montana. And you're right, this is a very fascinating mix of genres and styles. There's definitely the synth element from Immortal Girlfriend there, but there's also these interesting like acoustic guitar flourishes throughout. And it also features Kevin singing on it. He also plays drums on this record as well, live drums. And he doesn't sing in Immortal Girlfriend, but he sings here. It's a really fascinating mix. Over at Milwaukee Record, we talked to him about this record, and he says, Montana is me exploring. I love trap music, but I'm not a rapper. I thought, what if I make a trap beat, but instead play all the parts with real drums and somehow incorporate a singer-songwriter song? So the song we're going to listen to is my favorite from the record. It is called Par For You. And yes, this is the latest music from Mathu. Thank you.
are for you by Matthew. We're slowing it down a bit with this next track. It's somehow aptly titled, even though I don't think any loons make an appearance in this song. It is called A Flight of the Loon.
Flight of the Loon. Yes, this is the kind of song where it's, tell me that you recorded this at a lake house without actually telling me you recorded this at a lake house. The group in question is a newish group called As Oak. They got together over the course of like 2017 and 2018. They put out their debut EP in 2021. And now they have a new EP just released, and it is called Lake House Sessions. And as the title suggests, this five-piece group, they kind of hold up in a small house near a lake outside of Delafield for 3 days for like a long weekend, took all their instruments, all their equipment, all their recording equipment, and from morning until night, from the second they got up to the minute they went to bed, they just made music. They went in there with no kind of pre-written songs or anything. They just kind of jammed and created for 3 days. And the, like I said, the resulting EP is called Lake House Sessions, and the song we're going to be listening to, yes, is Flight of the Loon. I just discovered this album just a few days ago, and I'm really glad I did because I just really, really love it, and I really, really love this opening track. It's this very spacey, atmospheric, very chill and mellow. This one's an instrumental. And then in comes, as you'll hear, this harmonica, which is kind of an unusual instrument that you're not expecting in a song like this, and it just really sets a tone. Really, really love it. Has vocals later on in the record, kind of reminiscent of The National or Bon Iver. Certainly the whole holing up in a cabin for 3 days is also very reminiscent of Bon Iver. Just a fantastic record and a fantastic song. This is As Oak with Flight of the Loon. Flight of the Loon by As Oak. We are wrapping up things with a familiar voice, a former Lake Effect intern with a brand new name. She's a Milwaukee musician, and this song is really getting us in the mood for the holidays. I figured, yes, we need to have at least one holiday song here. So this is Murphy K with the song Holiday in 6/8. Now, Murphy K is part of a kind of a loose collective in Milwaukee, and I believe Madison as well, called Meltwater Pulse Collective. And this collective just put out a holiday compilation called A Very Melty Christmas, which is actually a nice nod to the old A Very Milky Christmas shows, if folks remember that from years and years ago that folks in Milwaukee used to do. So this is A Very Melty Christmas, and it has a collection of all original songs from this Meltwater Pulse Collective. And this has got to be my favorite. And I've always been a big fan of Murphy K. She's been putting out music under that name for a little while now. Her song from a couple years ago, Headlong, still one of my favorite songs of recent years. And this one really, really gets me too. I like it because it is a melancholy, very sad kind of Christmas song. Always a fan of that. Not that I don't want it to last longer, but I also like that it's like a minute long. So I just find myself listening to this over and over and over. I love the last line of this song too. She sings, "But a year from now, we will have gone our separate ways, but maybe for this Christmas, we're okay." Just gets me right where it counts. So yes, great new holiday track from Murphy K, Holiday in 6/8.
Driving December, the lining, the weather, the highway, in motion, the cliche, emotions, what do you get for the girl who has it all? Look at my light next to yours, it's rather small. By a year from now, we will have gone our separate ways. Maybe for this Christmas, we're okay.
Holiday in 6/8 by Murphy K. Now we are coming into this holiday season. It is already upon us. What are you looking forward to as this month wears on?
Well, speaking of the Murphy K track, I am looking forward to hopefully a slew of Milwaukee holiday songs. Every year, there's a couple keepers. The Murphy K track is definitely one of my favorites right now. I'm looking forward to a few more that'll hopefully come out in upcoming weeks. And like I said last month, I'm also looking forward to revisiting the year in Milwaukee music for our best of list or our favorite Milwaukee record list. I love doing that. I also love the folks who always release amazing music like on the last few days of the year, because just to spite, you know, people who want to get those year-end lists out a little early, there's always someone that will come out with an amazing album on like December 29th, and then you have to scramble to like add it to your list. So I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, just looking forward to enjoying the holidays.
All right. Well, Matt Wild, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record. Every month, he publishes his Milwaukee Music Roundup and shares a few of those songs with us. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And we want to hear your story ideas for Lake Effect. If you have an idea for an interview or a conversation that you'd like to hear on the show, give our Community Connection line a call. The number is 414-251-8970. You can also submit your ideas at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up, we'll learn how to make the perfect cup of tea from the folks at Rishi Tea and Botanicals. But first, we'll explore exoplanets and how the James Webb Telescope is helping illuminate them. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The James Webb Telescope was launched on December 25th, 2021. The first images from the Webb were revealed in July of this year. And the results were breathtaking, showing more color and detail than ever seen before. As the largest, most powerful space telescope ever built, the James Webb will serve as the premier deep space observatory for the next decade. Its capabilities will expand the search for new and exciting worlds beyond our solar system, including exploring exoplanets. UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium has an upcoming show all about exoplanets. And ahead of that, astronomy contributor Gene Creighton joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more.
So the James Webb Telescope was launched in December of 2021. It'll be almost a year coming up. So how does this telescope stand above all other telescopes that came before it?
Well, its size. So there are many, many actually space telescopes, and people don't realize that there's more than just the Hubble Space Telescope. This one has a mirror that's about four times bigger. In fact, it was so much bigger that they had to come up with a new scheme of building it because the mirror could not fit on any rocket that we had built. So we needed to come up with a kind of a petals on a flower, that open scheme. So that's one big difference. The other difference is that it's principally looking in infrared, which is the type of light that's longer, has wavelengths that are longer, lower energy than what our eyes are sensitive to. And the cool thing about infrared light is that you can see through murk. You can see through dust and clouds that visible light would not be able to see. So if you have a young star that's shrouded in all that material, infrared light can pierce through that and see that very young star.
So that's why some of the first images we were seeing were so picture clear, even though it was how many light years away. It's because the infrared light can cut through all of that.
It can, yeah. So it basically changes the game of what's possible to see.
So with this use of infrared and the new technology that was built in order to not just launch it, but to make sure it's sustainable up there for a long time, what's the main mission of the James Webb Telescope? I'm sure it serves a lot of purposes, but is there a main directive?
I'm sure that if you ask different people, you probably will get different answers depending on what they're interested in. But here is my answer for you. Because it has this large mirror, it means that it can do two things. It can look at really dim things that are nearby and really bright things that are extremely far away. Both of these capacities means that we can kind of explore some of the frontiers of what astronomy is doing now, both in terms of looking for faint things like planets around other stars that we call exoplanets. Relatively speaking, these are very close to us, a few hundreds of light years away at most. Or you can look at distant galaxies when the universe was only a small fraction of its current age. So you can do both of those things. And that helps you answer questions like both, could there be life elsewhere? And also, how did the universe come to be? Both of which are very exciting questions.
Definitely. So we'll focus on exoplanets first. You have an upcoming show at the Planetarium that's all about exploring exoplanets. So can you dive into a bit more about what an exoplanet is?
Right. So the word exo in Greek means outside, and that means that these are planets not in the solar system. Like, these are around other stars, other solar systems, if you will. And I think it kind of blows people's minds. It blows my mind, to be honest, because if you had asked me when I was a grad student, are there exoplanets? I would have said, we think so. But 20 years ago, we just didn't have the technology to find them. And since then, we have found more than 5,000. 5,000 exoplanets, of which approximately 300 are kind of like the Earth. So when I say like the Earth, I mean they're rocky and they have an atmosphere, probably. And they're at the right distance from their star. Well, that's pretty exciting because it means that of all those 5,000 exoplanets with the James Webb, we can focus on the ones that we think are more promising.
So, and I imagine that 5,000 is only going to grow and counting with the more images that James Webb will take. So you mentioned it's trying to focus on things that are most similar to Earth, at least in like, is there the potential for those fundamental building blocks of life? So what else do we hope the James Webb Telescope will tell us about exoplanets, the ones that we choose to focus on?
Right. So, and I should just explain that the James Webb Telescope isn't designed to find exoplanets. That's other missions' job. But it's supposed to say, of all these we're finding, which are the ones that we would like to dive into, and that's because they are at the right distance from their star. So we're not going to just willy-nilly use the James Webb to look at planets that are too close, say, to their star, because that's not promising for life, or too far. We would want to focus where they are at what we call the Goldilocks zone, not too close, not too far. Now, what we want to find is the chemistry in the atmosphere. That's what gets us excited. Why? Because, yes, we have an intuition that, say, water might be interesting, carbon, yes. But really what we're looking for are two gases that are so light that if they weren't constantly replenished by life, they would disappear. Methane and oxygen are so light that if nothing happened, if there was no living creatures on that planet, they would just dissipate into space. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for that kind of signature. And what's super exciting is that the James Webb now has proved multiple times that it's sensitive enough not only to see the light from an exoplanet, but it gets enough light to see the atmosphere of the exoplanet and what chemicals it finds in that atmosphere. So although we have not found oxygen yet or methane, I think it's a matter, well, I shouldn't say it's a matter of time, but that's the sort of thing that would tell us, boy, there might be life on this place. And I don't think we should imagine green people with antennas. It could be that it's microbial life, but still, that would make another world somewhere else having life, which means we're not alone.
Well, as you're alluding to, I think people jump ahead to, like, is there intelligent life out there? But at its base, it's like we're looking for life and the building blocks of it. So do you have any words of, like, wisdom or just a way to bring the scale of it down? Because when people who don't perhaps study astronomy or know, and they just hear that we're looking for life out there that's outside of our solar system, how do we kind of scale it back and explain what we're going to start with? It doesn't jump to, like, our other version of ourselves out there.
Right. Yeah, I don't think we're going to be finding Gene 2.0 out there for sure. So first of all, at this point, we're talking about what we call biosignatures. So nothing about this would be technological. This would be literally, you know, amoeba-like things, right? Very primitive, probably. We're talking about microorganisms. But another way of thinking of it, in addition, is space is really huge. There's a stupendous amount of space out there. And it's like saying, you know, we're going to take a glass, take some water from the ocean. Oh, we didn't find any life. That means the ocean doesn't have life. It doesn't follow. We're still using small cups in an ocean. It is, though, exciting. As I said before, it's exciting to me that we have now the technical capacity to even, you know, take a cup into the ocean.
And each cup is just essential for science and any progress we're going to make, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, in the last 20 years or so, we've increased our capacity by a factor of 1,000. So things that used to be completely not possible, now they are. So this is an exciting time to be doing this astronomical research.
That's exciting to talk about, Jean. Thanks again for joining me.
Thank you.
Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The Planetarium Show, Exploring Exoplanets with the James Webb Space Telescope, will take place December 2nd and 9th. You can find more information at wuwm.com. As the weather has been getting cooler, many of us have been looking to curl up with a good blanket and a cup of tea. Joshua Kaiser is the president and founder of Reishi Tea and Botanicals. He explains to WUWM's Mayon Silver how to brew the perfect cup.
It depends on the type of tea. Every tea has a different amount of tea that you would add to the teapot, and the water temperature is also very important. But as a basic rule of thumb, for green teas or black teas, anything in between, use 2 teaspoons per cup. Boil the water just off a boil. Add the water to the tea. Let it steep for 3 minutes and strain it in its entirety and enjoy it. It might be a little weak, it might be a little strong the first time. You can adjust the amount of tea and you can adjust the amount of time, but don't use water that's too hot or you'll extract too much tannin and the tea may become bitter.
You want to put the water in just as it starts boiling or just before it starts boiling?
Oh, good question. You want to bring the water to a boil and then let it cool down a little bit. So maybe boil the water and let it cool for 3-4 minutes and pour it over the tea.
Nice. Kind of like what people do with a French press with coffee a little bit, sort of.
Yeah, and French presses are awesome for herbal teas, scented teas, flavored teas. French presses are really utilitarian, easy to use kitchenwares for brewing tea.
And besides the French press, are there any other contraptions people should use? How do they know how long the tea should steep? Does it say on the box?
It does. For green teas and white teas, it's better to use porcelain or glass. And for more dark teas or fermented teas, it's nice to use earthenware teapots.
I see. Okay. And what about adding anything into it? Lemon, some people like milk. Is that, what's your take on that? Flavoring, sugar?
Yeah, I drink my teas neat. I never add any milk. I never add any sugar. Really fine teas have unique aromatic profiles, different levels of bitter sweetness and sweetness. And the aftertaste is something to behold. When you add lemon or milk or sugar to a fine tea, you're really missing the point. Tea is something that tastes just lovely on its own without any additives.
And for people who may not be able to take the caffeine in the tea, you know, the people that for health reasons stick with the herbal tea, are there favorites? You mentioned ginger. Is there something else that you would recommend for different properties?
Oh yeah, there's so many good teas with so many good herbs without caffeine. Rooibos is one, and it's similar to tea in that it has this reddish infusion, and it has a very special, almost like honey and fruity characteristic. You can steep it like a black tea. Rooibos is very nice. I think ginger, turmeric ginger, is something that's really good for our bodies and our immune systems. Those are very, very good teas for this season.
So you're encouraging people to sort of develop their tea taste buds.
Yes. And there's so many different varieties of tea that there's something out there for everybody. And certainly we think about eating seasonally. We can also think about drinking tea seasonally. During these cold winters, it's good to drink teas that will warm up your constitution, warm up your body, and increase your metabolism. So darker teas, more fermented teas, like a ruby oolong or a taeguanyin oolong or a pu'er tea, those are really good to warm up your body and during this winter time. Ginger is amazing. If you want to add sugar or lemon to anything, try a ginger tea or a ginger herbal tea or a turmeric ginger tea. Those are all amazing during this time of year.
Joshua Kaiser is the president and founder of Rishi Tea and Botanicals, based right here in Milwaukee. He spoke to WUWM's Mayon Silver last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn more about a proposed plan to knock down parts of I-794, making the surrounding area a more walkable and bikeable area. We'll learn more tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.